So I would also like to thank the organizers very much for allowing me to give a talk. And I want to also echo Ulrich's statement yesterday about also thanking the organizers for assembling such a wonderful group of people. And I likewise feel that this is a real community building. So I want to tell you about just one thing, one simple idea, which is measurements of active fluctuations in a cell nucleus. So first I want to just indicate the people who did this work with me. So Brian and Henry are graduate students working with me. Brian did the in vivo work that I'll show, and Henry has done the in vitro work. And Sarah is an undergraduate who's been doing some technical work on this project. So we're collaborating with Fred McIntosh on this because, as you'll see, I'm using his model to understand our data. Okay, so I'll just spend a minute talking about the general problem of active motion. In general, it's been, of course, the cell has this incessant motion that's turning things around. But in general, it's been hard to identify the active nature of this motion versus just the thermal nature of the motion. So experimentally, it's been challenging. One approach is to, in the same system, measure the active fluctuations by microrheology to drive fluctuations and measure passive fluctuations in the same system, and use that to separate active and thermal fluctuations. And that's showing a couple of experiments from Christoph's group here, both in vitro and then more recently in the cell, driving a cell and doing this active and passive segregation of the nature of the motions. There's also, in the last few years, been several reports of activity inside the cell, and we heard about it from Dave on Monday as well, that appears to be thermal in nature because of the exponent of the mean square displacement. So it looks to be diffusive, it's non-directed motion, but the amplitude is much higher than what one would expect from thermal. But again, isolating the microscopic origin of that has been challenging. Active motion has also been shown in the cell nucleus and also in E. coli. And that's been done by labeling a single locus on a chromosome, which one can do by fluorescently labeling DNA binding proteins, and watch the motion, both in E. coli and in the yeast nucleus. And then by doing drug interventions to interfere with ATP processes, it's been shown that, first of all, the motion appears to be subdiffusive. That was the term that's used to describe it, because it has an exponent less than one. And upon ATP intervention, the amplitude goes down. So this is a way to identify that these motions are non-equilibrium, that they're caused by activity in the cell. But the authors suggested that the time evolution was the same as thermal in character. So the interpretation of this exponent was via a fractional Langevin equation, and an effective diffusion coefficient was extracted. So the approach that was taken was some approach similar to what one would do with purely thermal motion that was restricted. And they happened to observe that the dependence of the amplitude with temperature was higher than one would get from diffusion, so it's also super thermal. So there's some puzzling aspects of this, but in particular, the authors concluded that the time evolution was similar to what one would expect from thermal motion. Okay, so what we've been doing is tracking the spindle pole bodies in the yeast nucleus using three-dimensional imaging. And these spindle pole bodies, you can think of them as it's the polar extent of the whole nucleus, and it's also the ends of the mitotic spindle. So I'll elaborate on that in a moment. So we do three-dimensional imaging and then tracking to extract the locations of those positions to high resolution, so less than 12 nanometers in three dimensions for each of these two spots. And those of you who know a little bit about yeast, you probably know they have 16 chromosomes, they have a 12 megabase genome. So it's not too dissimilar from higher eukaryotic cells like mammalian cells. So I want to just remind you about the stages of the cell cycle. And in these images, the microtubules are labeled in green, and the nuclear material, genetic material, is labeled in purple. And I want to just point out metaphase and anaphase. It's during these two phases that this spindle is formed and intact. There's a bipolar spindle. There's two nucleating centers for microtubules that have been formed. And the chromosomes are lined up during metaphase, and during anaphase, there's this large-scale transport of the genetic material to the opposite sides of the cell. So the way we can think about this, this is a schematic of yeast. Yeast have such a spindle. And as I mentioned, I'll be showing you data where we track the two ends of this architecture. So if you like, we're tracking the boundary of, and any motions that are going on internally are transmitted to those two boundaries. The types of forces that occur in the spindle that do this pushing are thought to be dominated by molecular motors and also microtubule polymerization and depolymerization. So that's going on all the time. And you might think that this motion is just purely directed and that there wouldn't be fluctuations, but I'm going to show you that there are fluctuations. So we image the cells on an agar pad that's nutrient-rich, and they also have a nutrient-rich medium. They are not motile, but we also prevent them from moving because they just very gently adhere to the agar. And we do this in the sort of dilute limit so that all the cells share the same mechanical environment. They're not prevented from dividing at the same rate. And what I'm showing here is projected into the two-dimensional plane, the locations of these two poles over time. I've color-coded the time evolution here from blue to red. And so during 20 minutes with one cell, I've picked out two cells that happen to have a bipolar spindle, so they have two poles. And these two cells show the sort of characteristic behavior that one sees in those two phases that I showed. So specifically, one sees what might look like random motion, but I'm showing you the difference, just the scalar quantity that is the distance between this pole and this pole in three dimensions. So that quantity has a lot of advantages because it's going to be immune to any rotation of the whole nucleus, any translation of the whole cell, or also any excursions out of the plane will be detected and not interpreted as fluctuations. It also can distinguish between these two phases. So this, where this large-scale directed transport is going on, anaphase, that's shown in blue here, and in red is a cell that remains in metaphase during the observation window. We image the cells very quickly in three dimensions at sub-second resolution, and we do so using a confocal microscope. It has 512 by 512 array of pinholes so that the exposure of the cells to the light is minimized. And we do so every 10 seconds. That's not limited by hardware. We could go sub-second if we like, but so that the cells continue to grow and divide normally. And again, we maintain them in a nutrient-rich environment. So this, I want to focus on this phase, metaphase, and I'll be showing you data extracted from cells that remain in this phase. These fluctuations are real. They're higher than our experimental noise. So the spindle is sitting there doing this. And our idea was that we could use these motions to find out something about the mechanics of the system. So I'm going to extract the frequency components of this signal by looking at the power spectral distribution. So that's shown here for a population of these cells. So there's over 30 cells here represented. And the blue is the average. The error bars are the first to third quartile of the cells. And so what we see is a power law behavior. First of all, there's a colored spectrum of the fluctuations. The power law is minus 1.3. And I'll show you that this is consistent with a force spectrum that's white noise, or frequency independent. So the force generators, just coming back to this, during the time scale of our observation window, this frequency, the frequencies that we observe are longer than the sort of coherence time of the force generation mechanisms that I talked about. So as Sam said yesterday, this should be in the white noise regime if it's active, if the fluctuations we see arise from active forces. So the likely candidates would be these microtubule motor proteins called kinesin 5s. They're tetrameric, so they combine simultaneously to two microtubules. And because the microtubules are nucleated from these opposite poles, their plus ends tend to be antiparallel in the spindle midzone. And so they act like the opposite of a muscle where you would have a myosin contracting the actin. So there's extensile forces going on all the time due to these motors. As well, there is force generation due to microtubule polymerization and depolymerization. Both of these types of forces have coherence times of the order of 5 seconds or less. So shorter than the time scale of our observation time scales. There's a couple of references for both microtubule dynamics and the specific coherence time of these motors that yeast have been measured as well in vitro. Okay, so we expect a white noise force spectrum, and specifically the model that I'm applying here, although it is true that any model that is based around these forces should give white noise down in this part of the spectrum. But the model of Fred McIntosh assumes that the motors, when they act, the motors or whatever is the force generating mechanism, act at the same force, that they act independently, and that there is some characteristic time. So the force spectrum should be the contribution in frequency space from each of these forces added up over all of these independently generated forces, each of which acts at some time according to some distribution with a characteristic time. And so from that, you get a Lorentzian that has this omega to the minus 2 behavior at high frequency. This is the force spectrum, and at low frequency, it's white noise. So this type of force spectrum is very different from what you would expect from thermal. In a viscoelastic medium characterized by some frequency-dependent modulus, you would expect for thermal fluctuations, you would see in the mean square displacement some evolution that goes like t to some exponent less than or equal to 1. And then the power spectral density, this pair correlation function that I, in frequency space, if we look at the fluctuations, we would see a frequency dependence also determined by this exponent, where this exponent is the exponent of the frequency dependent rheology of the modulus. So the physics behind that is that the fluctuations are totally coupled to the viscosity. If you have active forces, the fluctuations are no longer totally coupled to the viscosity, and the power spectral density should be just frequency to the mind. So it has a different dependence on the rheology. It will still depend on the viscoelastic response of the system, but you see, you would expect a different time dependence of the for the fluctuations, both in time and in frequency space. So more generally, in frequency space, if you have some fluctuation that's driven by some force, you would expect for active fluctuations that just this Hooke's law, basically the equivalent of Hooke's law, but in frequency space. So for white noise driving, if the force is frequency independent, you expect the fluctuation spectrum to just be proportional to 1 over the square of the viscoelastic modulus, the complex modulus. So we measure this, the complex modulus, by creating an in vitro system where we can measure the rheology of the DNA at a concentration that's meant to mimic the environment of the cell nucleus. And I'll focus on the frequency, the part of the spectrum that corresponds to our fluctuations. And at low frequency, we see the power law of the modulus is 0.65 for the complex modulus. And so using this for white noise four spectrum, this agrees completely with the power law that we see. And that's quite different from what one would expect for thermal motion. Here I'm showing 1 over the square of the modulus for the entire frequency range that overlaps with our fluctuations. So there's no fitted parameters here, except the magnitude here will depend on the number density of the motors and what's their duty cycle and so on. But it's of the order, the prefactors of the order of piconewtons, that's what one would get from that. So it's of the right order of magnitude. And so just to drive home the point that you would have a different time dependence from thermal, this is the prediction from fluctuation dissipation theorem. This is what you would expect for the pair distribution function of the power spectrum of the motions. So I'm plotting it here, again, for the measurement that we do from the in vitro system. So this is the beads embedded in our DNA system. If we look at their power spectrum in the green here, that's different from what we see in vivo. So again, this is the prediction from thermal fluctuations if the rheology is the same as the rheology in the cell. And this is the prediction from non-thermal fluctuations. Okay. Assuming the rheology is the same, and then the last thing that I want to say is that the rheology has been measured. This exponent agrees with what we would expect for the rheology of the nucleus as measured by Dennis Disher. So specifically, he's measured the compliance by using micropipette aspiration of not yeast nuclei, but mammalian cell nuclei. And he sees an exponent that's much lower than we see. And this would sort of agree with this if this was the thermal fluctuation spectrum. But yeast don't have laments or any similar nucleoskeletal structure. Okay, so when he does lamin knockdowns or stem cells that are undifferentiated and don't yet have lamins, you see an exponent very close to what we see for our in vitro system. And they also tracked, using fluorescence, the DNA, and they concluded that the rheology is dominated by the DNA in their in vitro experiments. So our measurements are consistent with a model for uncorrelated active fluctuations in dense DNA solutions that gives you the same time dependence as the data that I showed you at the beginning, but our interpretation of the origin is that they're not thermal in origin, but the force fluctuations that are implied by our model are far from thermal. Okay, so thank you for your attention.
Maria, when you talked about the rheology in the nucleus, was that from active rheology measurements, I presume?
No, it was a passive rheology outside the nucleus, as if the cell were dead.
But in a dead cell?
No, with DNA that's isolated, that's purified, and then assembled at a concentration similar to what one has in the nucleus.
But without motors?
Without motors.
Okay.
Without motors.
The power spectrum for the force has this characteristic timescale tau, which seems to be due to the fact that the motors are on and off within typical average on time or whatever. Has this ever, or can one check this kind of dynamics? Or
in vivo or in vitro? So in vitro, one can, and that's been measured both for conventional kinesins, but also this specific kinesin that I talked about. So it's less than 5 seconds.
And this is what you use then?
Pardon me?
This is what you use. I mean, I'm asking, this is not fitted, this is put...
So we're saying the force spectrum is frequency independent because it's beyond the tau of the motors.
And so you don't need the crossover. Okay.
Or even beyond the tau of the microtubule intrinsic dynamics.
Thanks.
Maria, I was also wondering about the forces. I mean, it might be interesting to look at the difference between metaphase and anaphase, Because in metaphase, you still have the attachments to the chromosomes, and maybe they dominate the fluctuations that are allowed between the spindle pole bodies. And in anaphase, that should be loose. So maybe there's a difference. Could you see that?
Well, so my student is looking at this. Sorry about this. My student is actually looking at the fluctuations right now. So in anaphase, you saw that curve, and it looks much more directed, and the fluctuations go down. And we've been fitting that to a model, and then she can look at the fluctuations on top of that. So that's one thing that we're doing. And then in vitro, we're also putting in, the mechanics probably is dominated by the DNA, and the DNA is still entangled because the cell, in the cell, because the cell needs this enzyme that can resolve entanglements double-stranded DNA. So we're doing an in vitro system where we're driving and measuring the active fluctuations and the passive fluctuations in the presence of this enzyme of DNA. So that tells us something about the base mechanics of the cell in anaphase. And then in vivo, we're looking at the fluctuations on top of that directed motion that you see.
Can you knock out dynein, actually, or was it?
We have knocked out dynein. Basically, the amplitude of the fluctuations go up. Dynein is not on the spindle. It should be out in the cytoplasm and possibly pulling from without. Is that what you're thinking?
Yeah,
about?
They're pulling from the end, so from the outside.
So it's puzzling to us because the fluctuation spectrum has the same color, so the same character, but the amplitude goes up. So you might expect it to go down because there's no pulling from the outside.
Or maybe they stabilize more than they pull.
They might be.
Maria, hi. So there are different models for how the DNA packs inside the nucleus, competing models like a fractal globule model and whatnot. I assume the in vitro experiment you did, you sort of packed the DNA in, but given various topological constraints of the DNA packing inside the nucleus, could you try to maybe falsify some of these theoretical models, at least do pack the DNA in some way in vitro, and then do your measurements, and then, of course, go inside the nucleus, and I guess then you have to maybe tag inside the nucleus, not just the spindle pole bodies.
That's another thing that we're working towards is putting the tag in, but in the presence of that reference system of the spindle pole bodies, so that we can measure those fluctuations at the same time as we're measuring the whole nucleus fluctuations and know what phase of the cell cycle that
we're in. Because there are people tagging nucleus at the nucleosome level and whatnot.
But it's just moving in free space and one doesn't know if it's rotating. The first part of your question, in terms of the structure. So first of all, it's not obvious that this should work, and it's just bare DNA. The first order thing to do would put in histones. But it's interesting that we do see the same rheology that Dennis Disher sees in his lamin-free. Lamins are, for people who don't know, those are the intermediate filaments that are inside the nucleus. So most nuclei have a cortex of lamins that are very similar to the cell cortex, but they're made up of intermediate filaments. Yeast don't have those, and when he does the experiment without those, he just sees the same exponent that we see in vitro for bare DNA. So we're not doing anything special to assemble it. It sort of implies that it doesn't really matter what's the superstructure. It's puzzling. So we haven't done that yet, but the first data that I showed you from, that was Julie Theriault's group. They did add, there's a drug called rifampin, something that starts with R, and it specifically targets, so they did the E. coli and the yeast. So no, we haven't done it yet in eukaryotic cells. No, we haven't blocked transcription. But we have added ATP drugs to deplete all ATP-dependent processes, which should also block the polymerases along with all the motors, and we don't see a statistically significant difference in the power spectrum. So what our current thinking is that it's the microtubule dynamics, that's the force generation that's going on during metaphase, and that the role of the motors is mainly structural. You can't remove both motors, but you can remove one or the other. The spindle collapses if the motors are completely knocked out, deleted genetically. So their role during metaphase might be primarily structural, similar to what Andreas talked about, where they can both cross-link and act as motors. During metaphase, they're probably mostly cross-linking, because, not because of pH, but because of phosphorylation level.
Thank you. Is there another question? No?
Thank you.